Another passage and account very familiar to many of us. I don't want it to be a history class, but when you deal with Daniel, you have to deal with history. And I thought what I'd do tonight for just a few moments is kind of bring us up to date where we are in Daniel chapter 5, because there's some interesting history, I think, in my mind. There's some interesting history and some points to be made from the history itself. But going back to what we've been talking about, and that's the structure of Daniel's chapters 2 through 7, you see chapter 2 and chapter 7 basically being about the same thing, as well as chapter 3 and chapter 6, and then 4 and 5 being the same. It's kind of how interesting how it's kind of sandwiched together in Daniel. We're going to be dealing with the prophecy of the four Gentile kingdoms and their end in chapter 7 in greater detail. We see God protecting His people in chapters 3 and 6, and I just got done putting together the PowerPoint for next week, Daniel 6, today. I had a few extra minutes of school and was able to put that together. I'm kind of looking forward to that. A lot of good stuff in chapter 6, a lot of good stuff in chapter 5 too. But a lot of good stuff in chapter 6. And then chapters 4 and 5, you see his dealings with Gentile kings as God is making known that he is to these kings. As I said, though, I want to deal with just a little bit about the history. Go back one. 606, kind of bring us up to date to where we are in chapter 5. 606, we see Daniel and his three friends being brought to Babylon. 605, Nebuchadnezzar defeats Assyria and Egypt at Carchemish, and this is recorded also in 2 Kings 24 and verse 7. Then as well in that year, Nebuchadnezzar ascends to the throne of Babylon. In 597, a second group of captives, about 10,000 Jews, are brought to Babylon, and this will include Ezekiel. Then in 586 B.C., the Jerusalem falls, the temple's destroyed during the reign of King Zedekiah. 562, Nebuchadnezzar dies. He's died when we get to chapter 5. I mean, he said chapter 4 was kind of towards the end of his reign, and when we get to chapter 5, he has died, and I just included some history here to kind of let you know what's happened in the empire. There's basically several rulers within a short period of time quickly after Nebuchadnezzar's death. His son, Evil Merodach, rules for a couple years, and he's murdered. And then this other fella, I have no idea how to pronounce his name, rules for 4 years. And at his death, he's succeeded by his son, this guy, down there at the bottom, and I don't know how to pronounce his name either. But then we get to Nabonus, and he's going to reign for 17 years, and he's kind of important to understanding chapter 5 just a little bit. In 553, a few years after his ascension to the throne, he goes to the oasis of to an oasis and devotes himself to the worship of his god, Sin. And he appoints his son Belshazzar as co-regent, as second ruler in Babylon. And that's where Belshazzar comes in. And when we get down to verse 7, where he says that he's going to make whoever can interpret the handwriting on the wall shall be third ruler in the kingdom, that's why he says third ruler, because he was a co-regent with his father. And for many years, up until about 1850, I want to say 18, what do I have on here? For years, historians knew nothing about Belshazzar, and in 1853, they find an inscription in stone is unearthed. And up until 1853, Daniel chapter 5 was a text that the historians and people that didn't believe in the Bible pointed to and said, the Bible's inaccurate. Talking about this Belshazzar. He never ruled in Babylon. Well, then in 1853, they find this text. And it talks about the fact that Nabonius had made his son Belshazzar a co-regent and ruled there. And as for Belshazzar, my firstborn son, my own child, let the fear of your great divinity be in his heart, and may he commit no sin, may he enjoy happiness and life. Nabonidus entrusted the army to his oldest son, his firstborn. The troops in the country he ordered under his command. He let everything go and trusted the kingship to him and himself. He started out for a long journey, the military forces of Akkad marching with him, and he turned to Tema deep in the west. So until 1853, nobody knew anything about Belshazzar other than what is recorded in Daniel chapter 5. And a lot of people said, you know, Bible isn't true. It's false. It has errors in it because of the fact that this guy Belshazzar is mentioned. Nabonidus returns to the throne in 540 or comes back to, because the Persians are marching on Babylon. He positions himself between the city and the Persians, and in October 10th, 539, he surrenders to Cyrus and is exiled. 2 days later, October 12th, the Persian armies overthrow the city of Babylon. And that's what we have recorded for us in Daniel chapter 5. Some say possibly it was the 2 days between when his father was defeated and the Persians are marching on Babylon that Daniel chapter 5 takes place. Whenever it is, it's close. Because we see at the end of chapter 5, the Persians conquer the city of Babylon and take it over. Okay, so that's kind of, like I said, a history lesson to bring us up to Daniel chapter 5. And if it is the case, if Belshazzar's father has been defeated and the Persians are marching on Babylon, I think we might understand why then Belshazzar does what he does in the first few verses of chapter 5. What's he doing in the first few verses of chapter 5? He throws a feast. Now, why would he throw a feast, do you suppose? Persians are at the gates. Why would he throw a feast? That's exactly right. The last hurrah. And notice who's here. A thousand of the lords have gathered together. As he throws a feast in verse 1. Let's go ahead and read the first few verses there. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king, his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. So we see him bringing his friends together. They're celebrating. They're safe within these massive walls, and you know the Persians are right outside, basically the city. And notice though what he does, and I think this is kind of the reason. There we go again. There we go. Verse 4. I want to take a look at verse 4. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass and of iron, of wood and stone. What do you make of verse 3 and 4? They bring all the vessels from Jerusalem out and then they drink this wine. Why does he do this? I don't know. Out of all the vessels, all the countries that they conquered, what are the vessels that he specifically asks for to be brought out? Jacob?
Sets forth what he was doing. I mean, he was exalting himself against
Yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, I was thinking about this, you know, of all the vessels he could have asked for, of everything he could have brought forth and used in this celebration. He called, I mean, think about the countries that they conquered. They conquered Egypt, which was the second greatest country in the world at that time. Israel was how big of a country? I mean, in the scale of the world, Israel was what? Very small and very insignificant. Seems like he would have asked for some of the greatest treasures of the world at that time to be brought out. But he asked for these. And I started asking myself, why would he ask for these? Was it on purpose? I think it was. Of course it was. He says he asked specifically for those. Did the people know about this one true God in the city of Babylon? You're shaking your head, Todd. Why did they know? How did they know about him? Yeah, and we're going to talk about how the city of Babylon falls. It's incredible what the Persians do. I don't want to get ahead of it because I'm going to read some of the stuff that they did in order to conquer the city of Babylon. Just amazing to me that they did what they did, and they didn't do it of their own accord. It was God helping them that in order to conquer the city, because they weren't able to go over or around the walls. They had to do something else, which is just amazing to me. But yeah, I think he's doing this on purpose. You think about the decree that Nebuchadnezzar sets forth in chapter 4 to the whole, you know, to the whole empire. And who is it he attributed what happened to him? And that's something that was well known. You think about our own government officials. How do, you know, there's the declaration, this great declaration, and I was thinking about our country, this great declaration by Nebuchadnezzar about the God of Israel and the God of Jehovah and this great and all-powerful God. And he is the God. He is the ultimate God. You know, how does our present president feel about our former president, Bush? He doesn't like him, does he? And every chance he gets, what's he do? He blames them for something, degrades them, downplays them. You know, and if you want to go further back, just ask anyone that is in the Democratic Party how they feel about Ronald Reagan. You know, it was like the worst thing that ever was. That's the nature of the world in politics. And I have the feeling it was the same way in Babylon. And that's how he knew about this. Vessels that had been conquered, and he's bringing them forth, bringing them out, and he's going to use these as he praises his gods here in Daniel chapter 5. All right, come on. Well, let's move on then. I'll catch up here in a second as soon as it comes on, catches up with me. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against a candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed and his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote against one another. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet, have a chain of gold about his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. So we see here, I'm going to catch up here to where I am, since give me a second, since it is working. that they could not then make known, the writing on the wall comes on, and they could not make known who or what it was. Notice then, as he asks for astrologers and wise men to come in, notice what happens in verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let thy thoughts not trouble thee, nor thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father the king, I say, thy father made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, for as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretations. Who is it his mother tells him to call? Daniel. And why? What's said there in verses 11 and 12? Why? Okay. Daniel stood out. Why did Daniel stand out? This goes back to chapter 1. This is repeated over and over again in the first 6. You're going to see the same thing repeated next week in chapter 6. I think in just about every chapter, it's repeated in one way or the other. Why is it he stood out? Because of who he served? Why else? Remember in chapter 1, what is it the Chaldeans wanted him to learn? Remember in chapter 1, what was it? They wanted him to learn worldly wisdom and knowledge. What is it? Go over to chapter 1 and verse 17. What is it that he learned? As for these four, God gave them knowledge and skill and learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. What is it they learned? Divine wisdom, divine knowledge, divine understanding. What is it in these two verses that the queen says Daniel has? What is it that she says he has? The divine wisdom, the divine knowledge, the divine understanding. And it was because of this he stood out. My children are grown. That how often do parents, whenever they come home from school, want to make sure that they get their schoolwork done, their children get their schoolwork done? And how often is it they make sure they get their Bible lessons done? What is it we push? What is it, unfortunately, a lot of times Christian parents push for their children to learn? The world's knowledge, the world's learning, the world's understanding. Would Daniel have stood out if he would have learned the Chaldean language, the Chaldean wisdom, and the Chaldean understanding? Would he have stood out? No, he stood out because he was different, because he thought different, he acted different, and he spoke different. And it's repeated over and over and over again. That's what's being said here. He's noticed. Is he liked? Was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego liked? They had people that were jealous of them. They wanted to kill him. Next week, you're going to see the exact same thing. The same reason why he is praised here is the reason why in chapter 6 he's thrown to the lions, and the same reason why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are put in the fire. So just because we have that divine, we're following the divine wisdom and have that divine understanding, that godliness, doesn't mean that everybody's going to receive us. It's interesting to note, and except for next week, in chapter 6, just about every single time in the book of Daniel, except for chapter 6, the first five chapters, when is it they are praised? Now think about this. When is it these men are praised for having this wisdom? When those in charge, what? Need something. When they need it. When they need something. That's when they're praised. Yes. With Nebuchadnezzar, I'm assuming that, and we're assuming that he kept that position through the next several rulers, but we don't know. You would think, but that go back to what I went over there. You have so much change and so much instability within the kingdom that who knows? You know, you had all these rulers within an eight-year period of time taking over. So I don't even know if Daniel was high up in the government at this time. It goes back to I don't know with all the change and the how it was in flux. Oh yes, he was. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's probably, I think I did the math, he's like 68 or 69 right here. And he's going to be in his 70s in chapter 6. Huh? Daniel. Yeah, Daniel's in his late 60s, 68 or 69. If he was 13 or 14 when he came, then he would have been about 68 or 69 right here. And he'll be in his mid-70s with the lions in chapter 6. His friends. Yeah. Not that Rehoboam or anybody else ever did anything like that. Yeah. Could be. Yep. Could be. Could be a retirement situation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. Jacob, do you have any ideas how old he would have been? Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Thanks for asking me a question. I don't know, Kurt. Anyone else? Yes, Bonnie. Yes, this is mother. Yep. Yep. Jacob?
Just thinking, you know, you said, where would Daniel be if he had stood out? I mean, thinking back to chapter 2, with all of the advisors of Nebuchadnezzar that couldn't tell him the dream or cover the dream, he said, off with their head. Mm-hmm. You know, they were killed. So he might not even be around if he had just been like the crowd. And sometimes we think, because we're going to stand out,
that's true. Excellent point. Todd? No, that's okay. Go ahead. That's an excellent point. Excellent point. Yep. Anyone else? And that's the whole point of Daniel, is it not? Is that the focus needs to be on God, and He will keep His promises so vividly brought out within the book itself, page after page. Good comments. Anyone else? I don't want to rush on. Trust me, I can move very quickly here as we move on. So Daniel was summoned. Moving on, catch up. King acknowledges that he is he, and then he promises to give Daniel the same reward that he had promised the others in verse 16. Let's go ahead and read verses 13 and following. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, Art thou that Daniel which art the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? So, you know, this verse, somebody was asking earlier about him. He didn't know him. He had to ask him, are you Daniel? And for whatever reason that he didn't know that he was Daniel, whether because he was older and maybe, as Ken pointed out, in retirement of some sort, or he had just been in favor of his friends and those who were close to him as opposed to the former wise men of a former ruler. Not that that doesn't even happen in our own country. You know, a new president comes in and they use all the same people that was there, right? Yes, they do. They get rid of them and they say, hey, I want to bring in my own people. And so Daniel has gone to the into the background to a degree. I have even heard of thee that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that the light and understanding and excellence, wisdom found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, and thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet, and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. And then Daniel goes on to say, I really don't want to have anything to do with this. Why would he say that? Yeah, Daniel knows what the writing on the wall is. That is, it's coming to an end. And secondly, think about what Belshazzar was drinking out of. What was he praising? What was he doing? Why would he want to be any part of that at all? I don't want to have anything to do with this. I'll give you interpretation, though. I will give you your interpretation. And that's what he does, is that he gives him the interpretation. And notice verses 18 and 19. O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and a majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would slew, and whom he would he keep alive, and whom he would set up, and whom he would put down. What's he saying here in verse 18 and 19? Which is one of the main themes of the book of Daniel. And I'm moving quickly because I want to get down to the end of this to talk about something else. That's all right. The emphasis is that God is in control. And notice the next verse then in verse 20. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was like the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed over whomsoever he will. What is Daniel telling the king here? What's he saying? Why does he bring this up? Yeah. Notice what Daniel says next. Remember who he's standing before and who he's talking to. Notice what he says next. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knowest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold and brass, iron, wood, stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. What's he do with the king? What's he say to him? Before he was humbled, he says, you were wrong in doing this. You know, Daniel never held back. He spoke what was on his mind.
Just think about Nebuchadnezzar and his reaction to the dream he had about the priest, and then the reaction that Belshazzar had when he saw the hand writing on the wall. It's very similar. So you almost wonder if everything was good.
Yeah. And I think this goes to also what I said earlier. When you take a look what Daniel says, he knew whose cups he was drinking out of. He knew it. He knew what it meant. Arrogance. Pride. It was a slap in God's face. And God said what? You're going to be humbled. And folks, let me tell you right now, this country is going to have the same thing happen to it. Because we are doing the exact same thing that this man did. And God is not going to stand by and watch it and let it go. Yep. Yeah. Thomas Jefferson said an uneducated populace will spell the doom of democracy. And the reason why he goes on to say after he says that is because the populace will not learn history. And that's exactly what's happening now. And you see it over and over again. This country is going to be humbled, just like this man and his country was humbled, and just like Nebuchadnezzar was humbled. Notice I have there, thou, and it's underlined, though thou knewest all this. He knew it all. He knew it all. And he doesn't say he doesn't know it all. He knew what he was doing as he is rebuked. Moving on. And then you see the writing on the wall. And we see here that then was a part of the hand was set before him. This writing was written, and this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Peres, the kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Think about what Daniel just told him. And what does he do to Daniel? He makes him third. He puts a gold chain. Think about what he just said to him. What did Daniel just tell him? First of all, I don't want your kingdom. What's that? And second of all, it's ended. And third of all, you're arrogant. I mean, that's what he just told him. You're arrogant, you're pompous, and because of this, this kingdom is going to fall. Is this really the way you'd expect this guy to respond? So why does he respond like this?
Maybe because he's thinking that he makes Daniel sick of a third in command overall. Maybe the Lord will take away the kingdom.
You know, that's what I came up with. Maybe he can go in favor with Daniel's God. And he just missed the whole point. As do most people who don't know God, miss the whole point. This is not what God wants. That's a good point. And notice the next verse. That's an excellent point. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Mede took the kingdom of being about 62 years old. Now, I don't have time to go through it all, but I'll just quickly tell you how the Persians conquered Babylon. Remember I told you that the Euphrates River ran right down the middle of Babylon? And it did. And they had these huge walls, as Todd's pointed out, and I talked about them last week, the double walls going around. There's no way anybody's going to be able to conquer, get through those walls. So what the Medes and Persians did is about 2 miles upriver, they built a dam, and they diverted the river into a dry lake bed. And it took about half the night, because they had gates that came down halfway into the Euphrates River, but not completely into the Euphrates River, down to the bottom. Because who would think that you were going to be an army could swim under the gates and get in there with those on the walls? And so when the river was diverted. And it, like I said, they finished the dam, and the river was diverted. The water lowered to where it was basically a swamp. And they say there was about 10 feet between the ground and the gates. And the Persian army marched under the gates and conquered the city in one night. Now, who was behind that? God was. That's not just something man comes up with. I mean, that's just incredible as to how they conquered the city. And it fell, as the Bible says, in one night. It was like the gates, the historians, and I have it, but it says it's like the gates were raised and the army just freely marched in. And that's basically what they did. That's basically what they did. In the same night, one night, the city was conquered. This mighty, great city was conquered. And then we get to Darius and the Medes taking over for quite some time. And next week we'll talk about Darius and his rule in Medo-Persia and his friendship with Daniel. Questions or comments? Next week we'll get into and finish chapter 6, and then we get into some easy stuff, chapter 7 through 12. Todd? And that's exactly what it is. Yeah, it is God that did it. There's no other way to get around that with the way it was set up and the way it was ultimately conquered. Thank you. Very good point. Anyone else? All right. I'll end a few minutes early. Maybe I'll get this cleaned up before Todd's ready to make announcements.